Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Once More with Feeling by Lama Tom Broadwater. As a follow-up to September's talk on the 12 links of dependent origination, we will take a deeper dive into this teaching of Kempo Karta Rinpoche. In this talk, we will emphasize the practice implications and application of the 12 links. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning, everybody. Nice to see you here on this really beautiful day. I see you got through the gauntlet of the marathon. I think there are a lot of streets that are closed off, so I'm glad you could make it. There's probably others that didn't, so. We'll begin by reciting the refuge prayer. It's a good way to start because it basically establishes our intention. And our intention is basically to be a benefit to other beings, to awake up and to be a benefit to other beings. And the safe refuge to awake up is the Buddha, his teachings, and those that follow him. That they are safe refuges to go to when we are suffering or when we are and when we are seeking awakening. So let's begin with that. And we'll say it in English three times. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. So again, welcome. I'm glad you could be here today. I had a nice drive over here from Zanesville, very pleasant. And it's getting even more beautiful out. It was a little cloudy earlier. So glad you're here. I think when you come to any kind of Dharma teaching, it's really good if you come with three attitudes. The first is to have a happy mind. We're alive. We got up this morning and we're alive. And life is precious. So we come with a happy mind. The other kind of mind that's good to come with is a loving mind, a mind that has goodwill and wishes the benefit of other beings. It's really painful to live a life where hate prevails. So it's good to come to any teaching, to any circumstance in life with love. And the final attitude to come to any teaching with is a big mind, to have a big mind. What does that mean? That means to have a mind that loves all beings, not just certain ones, not just our family, our friends, but all beings. Many of you don't know each other here in this room, but you can still love one another. And that's what the Buddha is telling us. Have a big mind, a mind open to all other beings. So today I'm going to do something I've never done before, and I've been teaching for about 13 years, something I've never done before, and that is to repeat myself. I gave a talk last month on the Wheel of Life, and I'm going to do it again. And I'm doing it for two reasons. One is, it's not a bad thing to repeat yourself. I one time went to a teaching here, not in the old building. Kimbo Sultram gave a talk, and all he did for the entire weekend was repeat a phrase. And it was, this is pure, that's pure, and it's just a list of all things that were pure. And he repeated that over and over again. This is pure, that's pure, blah, blah, blah. And we were to repeat after him. I have to tell you, at the time, I didn't quite understand why he would do that. But he's a very advanced teacher, obviously. But he was trying to teach us to become familiar with the idea that all things are empty, all things are pure. And so we spent the entire weekend just repeating things that were pure. Well, I'm not going to do that to you today. My teaching on the Wheel of Life will be slightly different than the last time, but not entirely different. And what I'm going to try to focus on is not just certain aspects, but to give the practice implications for the Wheel of Life. So, I gave you a handout, and the handout included what is called the Wheel of Life. The second page explains the outer rim, which are called the 12 links. You won't I won't be following that second page that closely, but it's something you can take home and sort of run over in your mind during the week. But this Wheel of Life is basically an explanation of how life after life is suffering. It's a graphic illustration of that. So in the middle, you see depicted in the very center, ignorance, aversion, and attachment in those three characters. In the next rim, you'll see people ascending and descending. On the left side, they are ascending. That means basically doing good deeds allows us into higher realms, and in the dark area, beings are going into the lower realms, which basically indicates that performing unskillful acts produces states of mind that result in our going into lower realms. I spent a lot of time last month discussing that. I won't this month. And the next area is the six realms depicted. It's sort of like a Tibetan cartoon. Every Buddhist school has something like this, but it's a unique contribution of the Tibetans to draw this sort of like cartoon for us to understand how life is. And basically, in those six realms at the very top are the God realms. People are enjoying themselves. And it is said that we go into that realm after death if we've cultivated a great deal of pride. It looks all really nice, but in fact, what happens, they live this wondrous life, but it's so great they never practice Dharma. And towards the end of their time in the God realm, when their karma for that has expired, they feel, oh my gosh, all this great stuff that I have, it's going to be gone. And so they foresee the future and they have great despair. So it's not such a great world to be living in. The next realm is called the demigod realm, and that's it's going to your right. descending from the God realm. And basically, that would be the result of being very competitive in life. And you can see they have nice things and everything, but they are combative, particularly against the gods in the God realm. And you see that tree growing up there, and someone's trying to chop it down. Basically, that's the idea here, is that it grows in their realm, but it goes up and ascends into the God realm. And so the fruit of that tree goes up to the gods, and they get nothing from it. And so they're jealous, and so the guy's trying to chop it down. The next realm is the animal realm, peaceful, quiet, but basically ignorant. And one of the things we know about animals is there's always a predator. So they're always looking out, sort of skittish, worried. But that's basically, if we've cultivated a great deal of ignorance in our lives, that's where we wind up. By the way, you might say, is this real? Well, I don't know if you want to believe this is real or not. You don't have to. But I asked Kempokarta Rinpoche one time, do these six realms actually exist? And he said, yes, they do actually exist. But even if you don't see them as actually existing, you can see them as psychological states. And these, I was talking to a fellow a couple days ago about this wheel of life, and he was looking at, and we were looking at these six realms, and he said to himself, you know, on any given day, I may be in all six of these realms at any given time. So it's like that. The next realm depicted is the realm, hell realms. And basically, it's a hellish existence and based upon anger. The next realm is the hungry ghosts. And basically, there they are, you know, they've got long necks and skinny arms and big bellies. And basically, there it's the result of greed. You wind up in that realm because of greed. And so anything they try to consume, because of their thin necks, they can't. Above that is the human realm, basically the desire realm. And this is the realm we humans live in, and we'll be talking about that in a little bit. Now, the realm that I, or the outer rim is the rim I want to talk about the most. And that's called the 12 links of dependent origination. Lots of words there. But basically, and I'll explain that in a moment. By the way, the outer guy there with his teeth into the whole circle is Yama. He's sometimes seen as a protector of actually Buddhist doctrine, but in this case, he's sort of the lord over life and death in samsara. So he's there sort of overlooking it. And also, I should tell you, up in the right-hand corner is the Buddha. And he's pointing, and he's not in samsara, he's pointing the way out of it. And that's towards the moon, which in Indian lore basically represents something cool, something beautiful, something beyond samsara. So it's like that. Let's talk a little bit about this outer rim, which again represents the 12 links, and you will see 12 links in that outer circle, the 12 links of dependent origination. So we all know birth, old age, sickness and death. We all know about it. And it was the Buddhist task to penetrate the causes of it. The teaching that I am giving today is basically Mahayana, just so you know how to identify it. Anyway, this teaching of the Buddha is so profound. It shows us how birth and death continue to roll on endlessly. His insight into these links of the chain of existence are expressed in that law of dependent origination. And what does that mean? Well, the thrust of this formula is that when certain conditions are present, they give rise to other conditions. It's really that simple to think of it in this way. One thing gives rise to another, and what arises gives causes conditions, subsequent conditions. So it's like that. And this view, it's a Buddhist view, avoids the eternalist view that there's some sort of outside agent sort of creating existence. It's not a theistic view. It basically says that whatever is existing is the result of a previous cause. And we'll get into that in just a moment. It also avoids the sort of the nihilist view that all things are the result of meaningless randomness. So let's look at this a little more. I think, as I said, all traditions, all Buddhist traditions, teach about these 12 links. There are different interpretations of that, but basically they're all in line with one another. Nothing seems to contradict what I've read from other traditions. So one way to look at this is that these 12 links point out that no thing is a thing in itself. No thing is a thing in itself, meaning nothing is the cause of itself. Okay? Does that make sense? So all things appear in relation to other things. So that's one way of looking at these 12 links. Another way to look at them is that they are a profound teaching about how consciousness arises. These 12 links or factors shape and drive the heart and push us unconsciously into suffering. So why do we study these links? Well, if we become aware of them, we have the potential to break the links that lead to suffering at a certain point in the chain. Again, very simple concept. That in this chain, if we can find where we can intervene, act, we can break this chain of unending birth, old age, sickness, and death, which is an endless cycle. And as we will see, this depicts that the currents that propel the mind into suffering are two. There's two things that do that. One is our ignorance, and the other is our craving. There is a Theravadan monk who wrote, "Right now, we are like the blindfolded bus driver, ignorance, driving at full speed with our foot to the pedal." And that foot to the pedal is our craving. So we are blindly craving. This is the story of our lives, isn't it? We ignorantly go from one thing to another. and that causes us our suffering. The second page, as I told you, explains these 12 links. You don't have to look at them now, but they are for you to look at later. You can follow if you want to, but they, what I say today won't exactly follow that. So the first link in this diagram is the blind man over sort of to your right hand, upper right hand corner. It's the blind man with the cane. And that represents ignorance. This comes to us from beginningless time. We have always been ignorant. Now, what does that mean from beginningless time? Well, from all eternity. Well, what's all eternity? Well, that's hard to wrap your mind around, isn't it? I mean, you say, well, it's this big. Well, it's this big. Well, no, it's beyond our being able to understand that. So for my money, you might say, for me, the best way to express beginningless time is to simply say, as far as back as we can remember, you know, beginningless time. We've always been ignorant. Ignorance is basically not to know the truth. So we come into this world not knowing the truth, not understanding Dharma, not understanding the Four Noble Truths, not understanding that this self that we attribute as being solid, real, and substantial is not that. And we ignorantly go about acting as if it were. So we are born into ignorance. It is what we come into this life with. And we wouldn't come into this life ignorant if we were Buddhists, but we've not broken this chain. So we come into this life ignorant. The second link is the potter making a bowl there. You can see that. And this is called formations. And this is something also we come in with. We come in with past karma. That might be the best way to express it. From previous lives, we come with past karma, both good and bad. And that sort of conditions our life. It molds our life. What we did in previous lives, our concepts from previous lives, molds how we will operate in this life. They're sort of, you could sort of say they're imprints. And they are brought into this life. And one of the big imprint that we bring into this life is that I am solid, real, and substantial. And that there is I and other, this duality we bring into this life. So the next is formations. It's sort of like our inheritance that we bring into this world. The next is, and it's, you can see the logical progression here, consciousness arises. This rebirth consciousness arises. And we call that rebirth consciousness. So whereas all this karma that we bring into this life is like a seed, the consciousness that arises in birth is the actual fruit of that past. Are you following me so far? You know, this can be, we can get really complicated here, but I'm trying to make it as simple as we possibly can. And so, if this consciousness arises, this consciousness finds a body-mind to inhabit. That's how we put it. So it, the next thing that arises is the body and mind, and that is seen in the picture. Well, consciousness, by the way, was the monkey running around. That's the third one there. He's consciousness sort of wildly running around, not tame. The next picture, which is form and name, or body mind, is the two people in a boat with someone steering, and that represents the body and mind. And together, the body and mind basically float on the stream of existence, you could say here. So what arises out of body and mind? The senses. The six, Buddhist thought, the mind is also a sense. So you have five windows, the five senses, and one door. And that door represents the mind. So if we have a body and a mind, we're going to have senses. Keep in mind, all throughout this, it's still being colored by our ignorance. Ignorance pervades this whole process. So if there are six senses, these six senses come in contact. And that is represented there at the bottom with a man and woman embraced. So this represents the senses coming in contact with the world. And the mind and the body interact in sensual perception. Next is feeling, and that's represented by this fellow with an arrow being hit, you know, in his eye. It's a rather stark picture. Basically, feelings are of three kinds. Well, yes, three kinds: positive, negative, and neutral. Pleasing, displeasing, and just sort of neither. So, as having this human body, it is inevitable, having this body, that I'm going to have contact. And I'm going to have feelings as a result of that contact. The arrow in the eye represents the swiftness or the accuracy of the outer world penetrating into our inner world. Just boom. The next one is craving, and that's represented by the fellow drinking. When we feel positive or negative, we're going to crave. We're going to desire. Meaning, when I come in contact with external reality, I'm going to either feel good, or I'm going to feel bad, or I'm going to feel neutral. And when something is unpleasant, we want to crave it. When we feel something that we don't like, we want to run like hell away from it. And if we're neutral, well, we just, you know, we're sort of unaware. We don't, you know, mindless about it. So this craving leads to attachment to the world and grasping. Kempo Karte Rinpoche called this grasping an addiction. I like that word better than grasping, because in craving, we're simply, you know, it's the desire. We feel it, but we you know, we take a drink. But the next thing is we want more and more and more. And so it's grasping. We want to hold on to whatever is pleasant, unpleasant, so forth. And in this picture of the Wheel of Life, this grasping is in the form of, the picture is of the man pulling out a fruit off the tree. We want to possess things. The next picture is a picture of becoming. Feelings, condition, desire, desire, conditions, grasping, which creates the conditions for or the seeds of a rebirth consciousness, another life. So all these things go together to create this one life. And this one life, once created through the various stages we've just spoken about, creates the conditions for a future life. But by this point, we're going to start creating karma because of grasping, pushing away and pulling in things. We become an individual who then creates the karma for a future lifetime. And that's represented here. Sometimes it's a picture of a woman moving towards a man. In this case, it's a pregnant woman. Then there is birth, you know, woman giving birth there in that picture. And a birth arises out of our previous consciousness. So we continue on over and over again. And of course, if there's birth, the last picture is someone carrying on his back a corpse. Very graphic, huh? So that's a picture of death. So old age, frailty, and death are inevitable truths of birth. We all have to age. I was telling someone earlier, I just hit my 75th birthday, and I was looking in one of these, they categorize people according to age cohorts, you know. From 65 to 75, you're old. From 75 to 85, you're old, old. So I just hit a milestone. I'm old, old. And then from 85 on, you're frail and old. So, but the point I'm trying to make to you is, and I thought not so long ago, I still have this young mind, I think, but I've got this old body. And I can't tell you how quickly time has passed. I remember vividly things I did when I was 5 years old. But like that, it's over. It's gone. So parenthetically here, may I say to you, cherish this precious life. It goes by so quickly. So on the night of his enlightenment, it's said that the Buddha worked backwards on these links. And he found the place where if you intervene, you can eventually become awakened. So he thought, why old age and death? Well, because of birth. Why birth? Actions of becoming, which are motivated by greed and hatred. Why actions of becoming? Grasping. And why grasping? Desire. And why desire? And so forth. You get the point. This is what they say the Buddha did on the night of his awakening. So where do we break this chain, this endless cycle of rebirth, old age, sickness, and death, and suffering? So first of all, there's absolutely nothing we can do about having a body mind. We can't intervene at that point. We're already here, you know. In the Vajrayana, and we're not going to talk about that today, there are interventions we do with body related to freeing ourselves, but that would be for another time and another teacher, because it is beyond my realm or scope of competency. But there is a point that we can intervene according to the Mahayana. And that is near the point where grasping and desire arise. When pleasant things arise, we don't have to grasp. When unpleasant things arise, we don't have to impulsively and wildly express aversion. When neutral things arise, we don't have to drift into mindlessness. We can continue to remain aware. So how do we do this? The Buddha taught us meditation, quietly abiding, as the Tibetans call it. It's a method of mindfulness awareness to tame the grasping, craving mind. And how do we do that in meditation? Every time a thought arises, whether it's something we like or we dislike, we treat it the same and allow it to pass. We don't suppress it. That's not what we do in meditation. When it arises, we recognize it. That's called awareness. And we let it drop. That's mindfulness, knowing what to do, what to adopt, and what to let go of. Now, that sounds easy, huh? But shamatha, as you all know who practice it, takes two things. One, you have to have a little bit of ethical conduct. What that means is you can't spend your day killing and stealing and looting and then sit down on the meditation cushion. You have to have a certain amount of ethical conduct. And in the Mahayana, it is cultivating the six paramitas. And the other things we have to do is we have to have a certain amount of stability. Even before we go into meditation, we have to calm ourselves. We have to have some stability in our lives, a place to go to practice. It doesn't mean your mind has to be tranquil. It just means there has to be a certain amount of stability in your life. I frequently come in contact with students whose lives are in chaos, mentally, psychologically, in so many different ways. And for them to right off the bat start trying to meditate is beyond their capacity. They have to get their lives in a bit of order before they can settle in. I mean, that's not a hard, fast rule, but generally speaking, one has to have some order to one's life in order to benefit from meditation. Some people can't sit initially in meditation, so what I've often prescribed to them is just walking meditation. There's, you know, you're still moving kinetically, but that can help quiet the mind too. So maybe if you can't sit, you can do walking meditation. I like to tell you that at the end of meditation, of shamatha, you're going to be enlightened. That's not the case. You also need wisdom. See, in the beginning, all this started out with ignorance, right? And so, in order to fully wake up, we can begin in meditation. But to fully wake up, we're going to need wisdom, the wisdom that knows things as they are. As long as we are ignorant, we're going to do ignorant stuff. There's a parable, from a Theravadan monk, and it's about a fellow sitting on the side of the road and he's eating hot chili peppers one after another, and he's, you know, tears going down his eyes, burning his mouth, and someone goes up to him and says, "Why are you doing that?" He says, "I'm trying to find the one sweet one." So as long as we're ignorant, we're always going to be searching after that one experience that's going to be completely satisfying. We're going to be eating the chili peppers. And what we have to understand that in samsara, there is never going to be that completely satisfying thought, circumstance, condition. We just showed in the Wheel of Life, the God realms, you know, they have everything. But in the end, they're not happy. You know, the people that are billionaires and millionaires, that does not necessarily mean they're happy, right? Many of them want more. And in the end, they, like us, die. But this man eating chili peppers and looking for the sweet one is ignorance. That is us. So as long as we lack wisdom, knowing how things really are, we will never decisively be free. We may decrease our craving and our grasping, but we need to realize the nature of how things really are. That's wisdom. When we are no longer driven by ignorance and desire, the whole mass of suffering collapses. So what do we do practically? And that's important. We can talk about this in the abstract, but what do we do practically? Well, there are many methods in Buddhism, and I will only speak of one in the Mahayana tradition. In this book called The Great Path of Awakening by Jhanab Khandrol, which is one of Lama Kathy's favorite books. She taught me out of it when I first came out of retreat. A wonderful book. In it, basically, there are four strategies or powers in life to accomplish our liberation. Simple strategies. And if we follow them, Jhanab Khandrol's telling us, we will find wisdom. So the first strategy is, and I'll explain it in a minute, keep the two bodhicittas always in your mind. What does that mean? Well, the two bodhicittas are the relative and ultimate bodhicitta. Relative bodhicitta, to say in a few words, is to want to always benefit other beings. Why is that going to liberate us? Because we're so much in grasping, we're so much into concern for ourselves. And if little bit by little bit we can drop that grasping, what do we say? We're going to be less and less suffering. So the first bodhicitta is relative. ultimate bodhicitta is what ultimately is real. What we think of as real is not solid, substantial, and real, particularly our concepts of self. So if we can stop dropping those kinds of concepts, we become wiser. There are slogans within this book, and one of the slogans is to recognize the dreamlike nature of reality. So from time to time during the day, we can say, oh, you know, this is all a dream. Now we can't do that all the time, but from time to time, if we can cultivate that lightness, you know, it's like a dream, instead of the heaviness of this being solid, real, and substantial, we gain wisdom. So the two bodhicittas, always keep them in mind. The second one, strategy in this book is maintain mindfulness awareness whether engaged in virtuous and even non-virtuous activity. Now that's weird. Why would you say be mindful and aware when you're doing something unvirtuous, right? I had a student once who was bound and determined to engage in something I considered unvirtuous. And I was, you know, what do I do here? What do I say to them? So I went to Lama Kathy and I said, Lama Kathy, this person is, no matter what I say or what I do, is going to engage in something I consider unvirtuous. It would harm other people. And she said, Lama Tom, what you do is you go back to them and you say, when you are engaging in that unvirtuous activity, to do two things. Be aware of what you're doing and be mindful of it, even in something unvirtuous. Why? Because we have the confidence in that person that eventually, if they are truly mindful, they will start to recognize that they are harming themselves and the other person. And that takes awareness, knowing what they're doing. So always cultivate mindfulness and awareness in whatever you're doing. Become familiar with training in bodhicitta again and again. The other thing to do is, the third strategy is everything you do, consider it planting a seed. Every action, every thought you do, consider it as planting a seed. Because you are. Either in this life or in the next life, whatever action you performed will bear fruit, will come to fruition. Whether in happy states, unhappy states, or liberation. The next strategy, according to the Mahayana and according to Jhandam Kantrol and the Great Path of Awakening, is repudiate forcefully, abandon ego cherishing when such thoughts come up. Now, this is a hard thing to do. Particularly when you feel you're wronged, right? That's really difficult. I feel self-righteous anger. I'm angry. But if we look behind that, an awful lot of it has to do with our own self-cherishing. So repudiate forcefully, abandon ego clinging when such thoughts arise. The final thing is aspire, here's another strategy, aspire to dedicate all activity for the awakening of beings. So you get up in the morning and you say, today I'm going to try to do virtuous activity for other beings. I'm going to try to help people. And then at night, when you look at your conscience and you see what you've done well, rather than taking pride in it, saying, may this, what I've done, benefit all beings. So those are strategies. By the way, I want to tell you something else, so you don't get the wrong impression. Desire is not something we necessarily have to abandon. There's good desire. I desire to help other beings. I want to be passionate about being compassionate to other beings. So desire in and of itself is not something at our stage we want to necessarily abandon. There are so many other practices that we could talk about that lead us towards liberation that are rich within our Buddhist tradition, both in the foundational vehicle, in the Mahayana, which is what I've spoken about today, and in the Vajrayana. So many. I've only talked about a few. But I assure you that if you adopt those strategies, it will lead you towards liberation. We have the Buddha's word for that. We have a few minutes, and I would love if there were be some questions or thoughts. And you can come up to the microphone if you will. And I also want to tell you there's no such thing as a question that is dumb. Sometimes I've gone to the microphone and said, boy, this is going to be a dumb question. I realize it's something very, can be very profound. So.
Hi, Lama Tom.
Good morning.
Good morning. I find that I have a lot of prideful thoughts. I was wondering what practices are available to work with those and to, what practices are available to work with prideful thoughts?
Yeah. So what do you think?
Maintaining bodhicitta, relative bodhicitta, generosity, I'm sure, maybe. I guess I'm not sure, but.
Yeah, without, telling a personal story, but when you say spiteful.
Prideful. Pride, like. I guess thinking that I have achieved more than someone else, in a way.
Well, in that case, there's always going to be people that have achieved more than you, and there's going to be people that achieve less than you. I mean, that's just the way it's always going to be, right? And what we normally do with people that we think have achieved more than us is to be spiteful. Well, they don't deserve that. I deserve that. They don't deserve that. And to those, and so the antidote, one of the antidotes to that is to. And it sounds a little phony right now, but practice saying, I rejoice in their good fortune. When you see, and again, that sounds a little phony right now. So it's a practice, and the practice you have to repeat, and it becomes real as you repeat it. You know, I rejoice. They did something well. To those that have achieved less than us, we all often look down on them, right? And the antidote to that is compassion. They're just like me. They struggle and suffer just like me. And I wish to give them whatever they need to grow.
that I struggle when I feel like I know what another person needs, and I offer too much help, and I think I know best, but I may not, so I struggle with that.
Oh, yeah. In our effort, our good intentions to be helpful to another person, it may be the very thing that turns them off, right? So we're not perfect, we're not Buddhas, we don't know exactly what's in your mind. We don't know exactly what your circumstances are that require our help. So we do the best we can. And if we do something and they say, get away from me. Our normal reaction is to say, well, the heck with you. And what is that? That's ego clinging. I should know what they want. I did everything I could. And so that's ego clinging. Recognize that. We're not perfect. We don't know. So, you know, our effort to help other people is always an experiment. And it never hurts to say to a person, how can I help you? And mean that sincerely and from the deepest part of your own heart.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. So if there are no more questions, we'll do what Chandam Kontrol says is a good thing to do after any activity. By the way, thank you so much for being here today. It's a beautiful day. You'd be out walking in the park or doing other things, but here you are. That creates merit. You're just a little closer, hopefully, to waking up. This is all good. But what we do is, rather than selfishly want to keep this to ourselves, we dedicate it for the benefit of all beings. May what we did today actually, sometime or another in the future, benefit ourselves and other beings. So let's do the dedication of merit. It's on the flip side of the refuge prayer. And we'll say it in English. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. Thank you so much, and I hope you have a really good week. And see you again soon. Again, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.